Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish reading a science fiction book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. This time it's a bit special, so if you're listening to this now on the podcast feed from the podcast, you can actually stop and you can actually see me do this live. Well, not live. It's a recording of me doing this live on video. So if you just press pause now and go to Ustream.tv /Luke Burridge or /channel/Luke Burridge, you'll be able to find a video of me doing this, which isn't all that interesting. It's just me. I'm sort of waving at the camera now. There's not many people watching it because I only announced it on Twitter and Facebook about 2 minutes ago. I just said, hey, live recording now. So let's get straight into the first of all, a bit of feedback. I've got some really good feedback over the past few weeks that I've mentioned on just the previous shows but didn't really get to. One really great bit of feedback comes from R. Brent Stansfield. I'll get into that in a second. But first of all, a message that I got last night about Post-Singularity, which I mentioned reading, starting and saying it was one of the worst books. And a guy called Dave on goodreads.com, he said, so, Luke, hi, I just listened to your podcast review of most of Last and First Men, which I forced myself to finish, albeit just barely. You had some fair criticisms of Stapleton's work, so I'm wondering what you hated about this one that's even worse. And when he says what he hated about this one, meaning Post-Singularity, what's even worse than Last and First Men? The thing is, I can't really compare them, the two of them, because one is, of course, a very influential science fiction work or a cultural kind of study, historical document from the 1930s, generally considered to be very influential, like I say, and has held up in a lot of people's eyes as a great piece of early science fiction. And Post Singularity is a free ebook that was being given away, and like not a lot of energy or effort had to be expended into either book. So the thing is, sometimes when a book is a little bit of a struggle and you're not quite sure where it's going, like Last and First Men, I'm really curious and I want to find out, so I keep reading. Even though at the end, it's not that I found it a bad book, I just found it not to be a book of the kind that I actually enjoy. I mean, I really enjoy science fiction, and while that was fiction, is in the way it wasn't true, there wasn't a whole lot of sort of the fiction ideals in there. I mean, it's really hard to explain, but you know, it just wasn't the book that I was looking for. The thing is, with Post Singularity by Rudy Rucker, it was a book that I was kind of looking for. It's a science fiction book, and it was free online, and that's just the kind of quick read that I wanted. The thing is, if you've ever actually started reading it, just read that first page and then just think, okay, I'm going to compare this to other great works of science fiction that are also on my list to read, sort of Hugo and Nebula award-winning Left Hand of Darkness, which I also wanted to get to, too. And you just realise that, wait a second, it's just not worth my time even spending any even thought or any more thought on this book at all. So maybe you can read it and enjoy it, but, you know, even if I'm going to just go for this sort of post-singularity kind of genre, almost, of fiction, there's a lot more out there which I'd rather read than that. Okay, on to a great bit of feedback from R. Brent Stansfield. This is quite a long email that he sent me, and so I've sort of edited it down here, just so I'll skip over bits and pieces as I read this. It goes, love the podcast, keep it up. I have an episode idea in case you've run out of books to review. I'm deeply disappointed with science fiction, TV and film. I'm turning back to books. As a scientist, I've always been drawn to science fiction. And then he goes, but as an academic, I have little time for pleasure reading, so I get most of my kicks from TV and film. Sadly, he says, science fiction in TV and film currently seems to exist to keep special effects producers employed. Fans are unaware. One can ruin a perfectly good party by challenging a science fiction film fan to name one scientific principle upheld in the Star Wars series. I have no choice, he says. I'm turning back to books. And this was a great email, actually. And the great thing is, like, I do enjoy watching science fiction movies, mainly because I often with these things, it's just action adventure. I like to turn off my brain and just go, woo, explosions, woo, that kind of stuff. So for that kind of thing, I really enjoy it. TV, I'm not so much into science fiction television. I'm one episode into Battlestar Galactica, and on the next work trip I do, I'll be taking the DVDs of the box set there to check it out. I'm not hugely into either films or more movies, science fiction-wise, except, like I say, to turn my brain off. The thing is, when I don't want to turn my brain off, when I actually want to start thinking, that is where, of course, science fiction writing really steps up to the plate. So I actually view them in two different ways. One, I just want crass entertainment. I just want to pass the time for a little bit. Another time is when I actually want to think. I like reading science fiction. And then he actually went on to say, I sort of didn't really reply that much in that, because I said, hey, I'll save some of these replies for the actual podcast. But he went on to ask me, he goes, what new authors or recent trends in science fiction writing that turn your head? What are they? After saying I don't read a huge amount of science fiction, I'm not in position to answer about new authors. He says, so my reply to that is, if you want to learn about new authors, this really isn't the podcast, because while I am interested in reading new books and in investigating new authors and stuff like that, it's not really the biggest point of this. This is just me reading books that I enjoy. And as you can see by even the title of this podcast and others that I've read recently, I'm just as interested in the classics going back, you know, 150 years of science fiction rather than just getting the latest reviews. If you do want to know about latest reviews or latest releases and things like that, there's like 1,000 blogs out there. And all these bloggers, they get sent books by the publishers and then they just churn out exactly, you know, you can pretty much swap any of like the 4-paragraph reviews that they give all these books, and you can just swap them between blogs and even swap them between books. You know, they do have insight into these novels that they're reading, but it's not even the same depth that I go into it. Generally they just rewrite the story in a few chapters and say if they liked it or not, which is great, but you know, that's not really what I'm into here. I'm more of a little bit of a deeper discussion of the themes and what's going on in the book. The thing is, when I actually mentioned that in an email back to is it Brent, his name? R. Brent Stansfield. He came back and he says, I must clarify. He says, I guess my interest really isn't your perception of the best stuff, but rather what you see coming up. For instance, you mentioned in your entertainingly frank review of Carl Sagan's Contacts that you're bemused that 80s science fiction presumes an infinite or nuclear-terminated Cold War. No one predicted the reality of an economic fizzle to the conflict. And then he asks his great questions, which is, what blind spots do you see in the current science fiction landscape? And it really is a great question. The thing is, because it's a blind spot, it's not just a blind spot to me, it's a blind spot to all authors as well. So I'm not sure what big impact is going to come onto into the world in a few years' time. That's the weird thing, is that a few years after 2001, you started seeing like the post-terrorist attacks on New York and Washington and 9/11, you see that coming into science fiction. It is very much a reactionary thing, but you can never just say, I'm going to write a book about a large terrorist attack. And if you do, it's just one of those things, and it wouldn't even stand out. It wouldn't be a theme of future science fiction. Now it is, I guess, because, you know, terrorist attacks, and there are different things going in there, you know, and people going in that way. One thing that I really enjoy is reading sort of alternative views and alternative theories of the future, because a lot of people, they write about climate change and global warming and stuff like that, and it's all like, okay, the world's gonna you know, turn into water world, you know, all the ice caps are gonna melt and the sea's gonna cover the land and things. But then I actually really enjoy reading, I think it was Fallen Angels by, there's like three authors, it was Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell and I think one other author, they wrote Fallen Angels about when the next ice age hits North America and Europe and things like that, and I actually really like that kind of take on it as well. So it doesn't matter what happens in the future. Maybe global climate change causes a new deep ice age. But it's not like nobody's going to see it coming, because some people have gone into that. Thing is, I don't just read science fiction and do this kind of thing. If I think there is a current, or not a current trend, like a future trend of a blind spot that I see in current science fiction, because I also like to write science fiction and come up with science fiction ideas myself and stories myself, it is something that I like to write about myself. I'm working now, I'm halfway through my sort of third completed novel. I've got lots of other projects that are sort of ongoing, or as I say, ongoing, not yet finished, I guess is one way to look at it. But one of the books that I'm currently writing and will finish writing for the National Novel Writing Month in November talks about... Well, let me put it this way. A lot of science fiction talks about technology for war, and there's like military science fiction. It always talks about what am I trying to say? Yeah, sort of like, hey, he has this gun and this gun is cool and it kills really, really well. And this is cool and that kills really well. And this tactic is great and this does really well. And I find that a lot of the world, a lot of science fiction, even non-military science fiction, it always talks about conflict and about... So you start, like, there's a situation, it's peaceful, then a situation turns up and suddenly it's not peaceful anymore, and then someone's got to win out in the end. And what I've been addressing a bit more in what I've been writing and what I'm trying to write is a bit more about the technology of peace, as in, what do you do? Because, you know, going to war and winning the battle is easy. You know, to write that in science fiction is easy, and you can make some great stories there. But what about, say, the situation now in Iraq? It's like, okay, what can we do? Or what would be the situation there, where you're not actually trying to find a military solution, you're trying to find a non-military solution, like a peaceful solution to get peace. Now, of course, you could just say, oh, it's all political and it's all this and all that and things like that, and that would make a good, you know, thriller or some kind of I'm not quite sure what to how to even approach that. Yeah, some kind of political thriller or something. You could talk about the peace in Iraq. But what I'm interested in is the technology behind the peace, not the technology behind the war, but the technology behind the peace. And that's what I'm going to try and approach, like I say, in this new novel. Like I said, half of it is written already, and I'm very pleased with it. It's come out really well so far, because the story is split into two time frames, and I've written the first time frame, which is actually set in a conflict. And it starts out, and it could almost be just a military science fiction novel, but it doesn't talk about the military techniques just for war, but also for peace as well. And that's something quite... I'm not saying it's new. I'm not saying it hasn't been done before. There's a book by... I was going to say it's by Arthur C. Clarke, but I think it was just his idea, and like that, and The Light of Other Days, and what's the one? Aftershocks, or the earthquake one. You know, he just comes up with an idea, writes a very brief outline, like a 4-page outline for a novel, then someone writes it for him. And yeah, I think there's a book called Trigger, which is about removing weapons from the world, which is good, but it's a little bit dull, to be honest. It takes it in a nice direction, but it's not so much a story, it's more just a technical demonstration of this one idea, which is good. But like I say, I'm thinking that is probably one of the unpredictable events in the future, or one of the themes that's going to come out in future science fiction, probably over the next 4 or 5 years. You'll start seeing more about peace rather than war. Maybe, I'm not sure, but that's my guess. And like I say, it's a blind spot, I think, but this is a blind spot that I'm hopefully going to address in my own science fiction. But that's a really great question. And if you've got any comments about anything that I've said here, just send in an email, luke@juggler.net. It'll be great to hear back about that kind of thing. Now, what time is it? It's exactly 3:00. There's 3 people watching online, which is interesting. And I've got someone coming around in half an hour. So let me crack on with this review that I'm going to do now, which sort of ties into what I've just talked about there a little bit. I'm going to review Edgar Rice Burroughs' Princess of Mars. It was published in 1912, and for the life of me, I don't know how long the book is. It's probably only about 150 pages, but I read it on my iPhone for free from Project Gutenberg, which you can also do. You can just download this stuff for free. And why did I read it? I read it because I've never read it before, really, and I really enjoy, I have really enjoyed lots of different kinds of science fiction, you know, hard science fiction and military science fiction, loads of different kind of stuff. But also there's the planetary romance. And this book was the very first, or the planetary romance that set the scene, if you will, for planetary romances in the future. It's very, 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 very influential. And of course, Edgar Rice Burroughs did go on to create another very much more famous kind of adventure series with his Tarzan books. But this book is the introduction to the character John Carter of Mars and his trip to Mars, yeah, from Earth and stuff like that. And so I'm just going to get straight into this. The world it's set on is, of course, Mars, but in this universe, the people of Mars call it Barsoom, and so that's why it's also called the Barsoom novels, or these Mars of Mars books by Edgar Rice Burroughs. And it's one of these dying world kind of things, but not too dying, because the people of Mars are trying to get it sorted out. Mars used to be very Earth-like, and there's lots of huge civilizations and things like that. But what happened is that it started drying up, and because Mars started cooling down and drying up, the people of Mars, they engineered canals to get water from the North Pole and the South Pole and to bring it up to the up into the warmer areas and stuff like that. So it's based very much on the, was it Percival Lowell's, his observations or his writings about the canals on Mars, which we all know never really existed. But yes, these canals, but he didn't also see canals, he saw seas, dried up seabeds and cities and things like that. Also on Mars, there isn't just there's a few different kinds of aliens or a few different kinds of species. You've got the green. Oh, so let me just start this way. You got the red Martians, which are pretty much humans. They look very much like humans. No problem at all there. They just got darker skins. And then you've got the white apes, which are like apes but white, and they're very violent. And then you've got the green Martians, which are these big, sort of like they're twice the height of a human, sort of like, or maybe 20 foot high or something like that, and big and strong, and got everyone, you know, these have got six arms and they ride things and they're a very warlike kind of race. Now, the red Martians, let's go back to there, they're the ones of civilized, you know, the white apes are completely vicious and completely all kinds of, you know, they're the sort of wild men, and you know, if you see them, just kill them, because there's no way to reason with a white ape. They don't have any kind of language or anything like that, and they're not really talked about very much in this book. And then there's final one, like I say, the green Martians are very warlike, and they don't have love, and they don't have friendship, and they don't have any human emotions and things like that, but they do organize themselves into tribes, and they've got this really weird life cycle, which is explained quite a bit at the beginning of the book, and yeah, so it's so that's the setup, really. Now, there's a bit of technology and stuff like that, which I'll talk about later, but it doesn't have a lot of bearing at this point, so I'll just get straight into the story. Now, the story is this. John Carter is a Civil War veteran in North America from Virginia, and he goes off prospecting after the Civil War, and he gets chased down by Indians, and in the cave, and he gets chased down by Red Indians, Native Americans, and then he gets into this cave, and he's injured, and he passes out, and he wakes up, and there's a bright light in the sky, and the next thing he knows is he's on Mars. Yep, this is very much sort of like a kind of fantasy kind of set up here. No science fiction. It's not like a trip to the moon or anything like that. It's where you like have to go, okay, how are we going to get there? It's like, no, don't worry about how he's going to get there. He's just there. And this is actually quite a good thing that you see turning up again time and time and time again in planetary romances. Generally, what will happen is someone will be on a spaceship and it just crash lands on the planet, and suddenly the guy is there and he's just the only human on the planet. And this is also like in the previous review that I did of the Left Hand of Darkness. It's just like, okay, he didn't crash land on the planet, but he's just there on the planet, and he's the only human on the planet, and he's just got to get by with his own wits and stuff like that. So that's one thing that you see time and time again in planetary romances. And here, like, not even a nod to science. It's just a pure gets transported over to Mars, a bit like the time traveler in the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, where he just sort of falls asleep and then, hey, I've time travel, yay, like that. It's not like H.G. Wells, okay, let's get into this machine and press this dial and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, he goes up there and he immediately finds himself to be very strong, because he's the gravity is much weaker on Mars, and he's a lot bigger and he can jump around and bound around, and he's like a Superman figure there. And he meets up with the green aliens and the white apes and the red aliens. And once he's captured, he finds quite quickly that there's another person captured by the same band of green aliens, and this is the Princess of Mars from the title. I can't remember her name now, it's not really important, but what happens is that John Carter gets a hard-on, and then the rest of the book is pretty much him traveling around trying to rescue the girl. And it's like this like action adventure, very much like a travel diary, well, not so much a diary but of a travel log. And it's just non-stop. It's like, okay, I kill this person, go there, find my way across here, fight this person, meet this person, fight this person, kill this person, fight this person, kill this person, invade this country with this army. You know, it just keeps going on like that. And it's not a very interesting story, but I mean, when it came out, it was probably quite interesting, but does play into very much of the stereotypes of damsel in distress, hero goes and saves her. One thing that I do like about the story, though, and this is actually quite noticeable, that even though it was serialized, I do know this was serialized in the like short fiction magazines, it was actually written as a complete story first, and then serialized. So it does have some overall consistency to the story. Even if it's not a very complex story, it does have some overall consistency. So the things that are investigated or described at the beginning of the story do have some kind of play at the end. And the rules that are set up at the beginning of the story are still in play at the end. Even though you find out new things and there's mysteries that are solved and things like that and new technologies introduced, generally the idea and the scope of the story at the beginning is the same as the end. Unlike all the serialized novels which are written as a few short stories, or they wrote part one and then they're like, oh, that went down well, here's part two. Oh, that went down well, here's part three. This one does have a through thread that is which makes it a lot more readable than, say, the book Slan by Ian Van Vogt, which is I wouldn't say a similar book, same kind of pulpy kind of aesthetic there. But yeah, here it is. The characters, moving straight onto the characters, there aren't really very many interesting characters. Of course, there is John Carter, John Carter of Mars. He's the main guy. And he is the archetypal hero. He swashes his buckles and he rides on his mounts and he rescues the girls. And he's exactly the same at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book. There's no character arc, as we'd call it these days in fiction and films like that. He just starts off and just goes for it, really. Same with the princess. She's there and she's like headstrong and she's like this, you know, independent, and she stands up to her tormentors and things like that. But in the end, she doesn't really do a whole lot for herself. All she does is wait there until John Carter rescues her. Also, the evil people are evil no matter what happens. You know, you've got the main bad guy, you've got the main bad woman, and things like that. And you've got the person who wants to take the princess, wants to kidnap the princess, and of course he's going to marry her and not going to let anyone else. So that's a bit strange. So you've got this very kind of like, okay, good versus evil, but no grey area at all in between. There is actually one character who you do find out about, actually two characters, and these are two of the like the monstrous green Martians, and one of them is the first green Martian that John Carter meets, and he's this like chieftain in the tribe there, and he does have a bit of a story, and so does another one of those who is sort of like, okay, this is an alien, but it's this barbaric alien tribe, but there's these two alien figures in it who are somehow a little bit, well, they're not more human, but they have more emotions, and they're a bit more like shades of grey there as well. But even one of those is an alien, but not a shade of black or grey at all, just a pure white alien. So it is a bit strange in that way, but there is this one character who's the main chieftain, or one of the main chieftains of the green aliens, who does go through a journey. And of course, that's the story that you actually really like, and he is the person, or he is the one who really gets the end of the story and wraps it all up. So even though this is John Carter of Mars's story, it is actually this green alien's, I should have written down his name, I didn't make any notes when I read this book at all because it was so short. And I should really look it up on Wikipedia or something like that. Anyway, moving on to science and technology aspects of the book. We have telepathy, which is a great thing as well, and you can really see why this is a forerunner to books like, I say, Left Hand of Darkness. I'm just tying it back to last week's review. Very much the same kind of thing. You got onto a planet. Oh, how do you connect with people? Oh, a telepathic connection is a really good way of not having to do too much technology. So if you suddenly need something but you don't have electricity, you can just go, oh, there's like some telekinetic kind of thing going on there, telepathic kind of thing going on, and it looks good. Of course, it's completely, these days you don't see that at all, because we can just say, oh, it's set in the future. Well, we'll just have a chip in the brain and a button that you presses, and it can all be done electronically. But back in the early 20th century, you didn't have all of that kind of stuff. So telepathy is what took over there. You also get the great thing, which is the terraforming, or like the reverse terraforming kind of process going on there, because Mars is all drying out and it's getting dark and stuff. So you've got this big atmosphere processing plant, which when you read about it, I'm thinking like, say, in Aliens and things like that, where they go to the thing and they've got this processing plant there, and this is a big thing, and this is like a big fortress as well, because everyone relies on it. So everyone's like, okay, don't touch it, nobody is allowed to break in there, because if the atmosphere plant breaks, that'll be it. So it's all locked up and nobody can come in or out except for the acolytes, the people who, like, there's two people in the whole world who can use the plant. And when I was reading this, I was thinking, wow, this sounds a bit like, this sounds like it's going to be a bit of trouble in the future. And of course, it does come in play into it in the latter parts of the book, where one of the it's not just one of the atmosphere plans. It turns out there's just one on the whole of Mars, which seems a bit of a strange thing. It's like, have they never heard of Murphy's Law? It's not that if something can go wrong, it will. But if you design something where there's two outcomes and one outcome comes to, like, leads to disaster, someone is going to choose that outcome, or that outcome is going to be selected randomly at some point and it will end a disaster. That's sort of like a long wrap-up of Murphy's Law. And it's like, didn't nobody ever tell these Martians that? They seem to be quite clever, you know, they're quite intelligent, except for doing that kind of thing. You do have floating ships, which makes for good, like, aerial battles and things like that. It's a bit strange, though, but it is fun. Not quite sure how it works. Some kind of crystal on board, which reverses gravity and shines gravity back down itself, which is a bit strange. And there's other things, but generally it's very much set up, what you'd say now is steampunk, but of course it's not steampunk, but, you know, machines and telepathy and swords and things like that. They do have some sharpshooting guns, which is pretty good fun, but they're not always used, and sometimes you think, well, why don't they just use that? But they never do. And then you go, but there was this other thing that they could be using it now. Why aren't they just doing that? That's not explained either. Again, the application of science and technology in the novel isn't the most consistent. One more thing about science and technology. Of course, the whole setup of Mars is completely bonkers, but nobody really cares. So when I was reading this, I was thinking, okay, I'm not going to think of this as Mars. I'm just going to think of it as another planet, because it doesn't actually matter that it's Mars at all. It just has to be another planet. It could be Venus. It could be a planet in the Andromeda galaxy or something like that. You know, it doesn't actually matter. It just means that it's not Earth. You know, how the Martians look down at Earth does come into play a little bit, but it's not really that important at all. It just means he just has to be on a different planet. So as long as, if you think, oh, it's not Mars, it can just be another planet which is drying up and they're getting canals down and from the poles and stuff, it works out. But one thing I didn't quite understand was the gravity. It's like he hadn't quite worked out actually how strong is Mars gravity, because John Carter, he's, as I said before, he's got Earth strength, and then he goes to Mars, and suddenly he's got Earth strength on Mars. So he becomes like this Superman character who can jump 150 feet in the air and or in a distance or something like that. But that's really not the gravity. I think the gravity of Mars compared to Earth is about maybe like 35, 40%. I can't remember the exact figure, but it's about that. When you should just Google gravity on Mars, it'll probably come up straight away. But so it doesn't mean that you can jump 150 feet. It means that if you can jump 6 feet now, it means you could probably jump around about 12 feet. So it's that kind of strange thing that he kept on getting into these situations. He's like, oh, I'll just jump across there and nobody else can, which is a bit strange considering he is obviously anatomically identical to the local. So it's like, it's not like his physiology is different. It's not like he's got bigger or more muscles or anything. He does fit in straight away. It's just obviously Earth muscles on exactly the same frame and more powerful than Mars muscles, which is a bit strange, but hey, it's a fun device. It makes him into a superhero character, so that's quite interesting. Moving on, the writing style. I actually really enjoyed it. It's got this great device at the beginning where it's like, hi, my name's Edgar Rice Burroughs, and I had this really weird uncle. He didn't talk very much, and he disappeared for like 10 years once. And then he came back, and it was a bit weird. And then when he was going to die, he said, hey, here's some writing that I've been doing. You're not allowed to publish it for 21 years. And then he disappears off by himself. So it's a bit of a strange thing. And then, of course, Edgar Rice Burroughs took these documents from his great uncle, John Carter, and publishes them, though. So it's quite a little fun framing device there. These days, in science fiction, it's very rare that you get that kind of framing device, but it's over and over in these old science fiction books you get it. Say in The Time Machine, just going back to some books that I reviewed here for this podcast, The Time Machine, it's sort of like, oh yeah, I'm a journalist and I met this guy and this is the story that he told me. And in Last and First Men, it's sort of like, oh yeah, I'm a man 10 million years in the future or billion years in the future, whatever it's going to be, and I'm projecting my thoughts back to the writer who is going to write this down now, you know. So it is these kind of things that go on with these old science fiction books that I really do enjoy. And in fact, I think I'd really, well, I'll talk about that in a bit more when I, stuff that the way you see this coming up these days. But the writing style, it is quite fresh. It does very matter of fact. It's just like they're in this situation and there's a battle and then the battle's over. And it's sort of like, wow, that battle lasted about two sentences. And sometimes you want a bit more. So when it comes down into like personal one-on-one battles, there's like, especially at the beginning of the book where it's all new and interesting, it really goes into those in a lot of detail. But later on in the book, it can sum up whole battles in just a few lines, which is good. I recently read The Steel Remains by Richard M. Morgan, and it's just a fantasy book. Very similar to this. Well, I wouldn't say very similar, but it's a quest story. Lots of sword fighting and things on this weird alien planet with aliens and stuff like that. So there's sort of like, in this way, that planetary romance is sort of like almost the meeting point between science fiction and fantasy. So a book like Lord Valentine's Castle or The Steel Remains is one of these things that you go, okay, it's planetary romance fantasy kind of thing, is it? You know, secondary world kind of thing, or is it science fiction? You're never quite sure. Of course, you've got to read later on into the stories to find out a lot of these places. But that book, when you get onto the writing style, it sort of battles at the beginning, but then the battle at the end is described in just as much detail as the battle at the beginning, even though there's more there. But sometimes you just want, okay, there's going to be a battle. And at this point in the book, you really just want the story to get on with it. It's like, who's going to win? Who's going to get on with it? And just do it. We don't need to get the later battles blow by blow by blow. You just need that, like, the overall tactics and the winner, which is actually quite nice. Not always, but I'm saying that sometimes that kind of getting straight to the point, to the point of the blade, is what you want. The writing is very dated, though, but I really did enjoy it. It is a fast read. I read it in like a few days, or well, probably only a few hours of reading, of course, but it was spread over a few days. Moving on to last thing I normally talk about is the themes of the book. Now, of course, there is lots of themes here as well. You could, nowadays, when you're reading it, you could, oh, this is about racism, or this is about conflict, or this is about this or that. What I really got out of the book, though, is morality. And that's what I said before, it's about this good versus evil. But of course, you get the hero archetype, which is John Carter to a T, and he's just sort of like, oh, I'm in this situation, let's kill this person. And you go, oh, I mean, I'll just kill over this, and we're going to fight here and fight there as well. So it's always that solution to the problem is to, hey, let me get out my sword and stab, 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 stab. And it's not always that, but it's sort of like the things that he's fighting for. If he's just fighting for his own survival, yeah, I can understand it. It's like, whoever wants to kill you, you can kill them for your own survival. And you think, okay, that's okay, that's where we go with that. It's sort of like, oh, you want to fight for, you know, freedom and stuff like that. It's okay, yeah, you can start doing that. You got there. You want to fight for somebody else. It's like, yeah, okay. But then it's just like, it's literally John Carter gets a hard on. It's just like, I want this woman. This woman is the woman for me, and I want her. And it gets to the point where he launches, I'm not really giving much away because you can sort of see it coming, but he launches an entire war, destroys multiple cities, there's like this utter genocide, completely wipes out a whole race of Martians. And in the end, it's just for like, oh yeah, it's because I want this woman, she was going to be mine. It's sort of like, oh, and you want her, well, you can't have her, I'm going to kill you. Blech. And it just goes on and on. It's like, and they go, oh no, it's great because at the end of the book, everyone's in peace and everything's sorted out, you know. And then, of course, there's still the thing in the back of your mind going, well, really, was it really for uniting these alien species, these Martian Barsoomians, and doing all that kind of thing? Because they say, yeah, we're united and in peace, but it's sort of like at the cost of the destruction of all your enemies and of of genocide. So is genocide worth peace and security and getting the woman you want and becoming a prince of Mars yourself? And I'm thinking maybe not yet. The book is just purely like John Carter, good, green aliens evil, some red aliens evil, you know. And it's just this weird thing. And then the person who is described as evil, or one of those women who's described as evil, you're looking at it and thinking, wait a second, yeah, she is evil, but then she's trying to preserve her way of life. So it's sort of like these things that the way the book is presented, it's like really weird to read it now these days with maybe a slightly more complex ethical outlook than is being portrayed in the book. Now, I don't know what Edgar Rice Burroughs actually, his political views and his morality and ethical views were or anything like that at all. But you know, the way it's portrayed in the book, I thought was quite an interesting read. And where, of course, if it was told from a slightly different point of view, John Carter would be the anti-hero rather than the pure hero that he is. Okay. I think that's pretty much all I want to say about the book, though. I've had a lot of fun reading it and a lot of fun discussing it, thinking about it. And it doesn't really compare, I don't quite think, with Jules Verne's book that I read and the H.G. Wells novels, like early science fiction, as good science fiction. But this book, it did spawn an entire, like those other books, which, you know, spawned, you know, time travel. Well, not so much time travel, but, you know, the ways of looking at science fiction. This also did spawn an entire genre, which was an entire genre... wrapped up in, I guess, body count and explosions, which is bringing it back to the what I said before at the beginning of the podcast. I knew this was going to tie in later on. This book is pretty much like the stupid action movies of today. You know, you just imagine John Carter of Mars. It's actually being made into a film. I looked it up there. And you just imagine, okay, it's going to be... trying to think of who the big action star is, like someone like Jason Statham or something like that, and then Megan Fox would be the princess, and then they'd get in some British actor to play like the old king and stuff like that. So you're just getting, okay, you know, this is going to be it. It's going to be big, it's going to be explosions, it's going to be like lots of people died, swords and guns and stuff like that. So it should be really good fun as a film. But back in the 19-teens, this is, like you say, published in 1912, this was it. This was the Pulp Fiction of the time. This was the action movie of the time before action movies really kicked into gear with you know, they'll be coming along in a few decades. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that people read for that escapism and enjoyment that you still get from watching the stupid science fiction movies that come out today. So on that level, I really enjoyed it. And also, I felt like the historical view of it, to see where the planetary romance comes from, which is also the subgenre that I really enjoy. So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. I don't quite think it's worth 4 stars because it is just so stupid in some places. But if you just give in to that and you really enjoy it, I know I certainly did. Let me just, I did make a note here. I was chatting to Jesse from the SFF Audio podcast, which is really good fun. You should listen to it. Go to sffaudio.com, I guess, and you can find it there, or search for it on iTunes. Anyway, we were chatting the other day on Skype, and I mentioned that this book, and he was saying, oh yeah, they're going to do a film about it. And this, not at this point, sometimes I'll be going, oh yeah, another film. Like, not really groaning, because I don't really care about films enough that if they do a film of a book I like, it never spoils the book for me. It's just another take on it, and that's no problem for me at all. But it is quite funny that sometimes the only thing that stops Hollywood ripping the books off completely and completely ruining them for a lot of people, or missing the point completely, which often happens, is that they just don't get made. You know, they start making it and then it's just like, yeah, but we're not actually going to make it now. But I looked it up online, and this one is being directed, John Carter of Mars, as it's going to be called, is being directed by Andrew Stanton, who is the Pixar guy, or one of the Pixar guys. There's Andrew Stanton, and is it John Lasseter or something like that? And so he directed WALL-E, which was one of my favourite science fiction films of the past few years, let me say that. I'm sort of cautiously optimistic because, you know, he directed... I can't remember which other Pixar films that he directed. Like Finding Nemo, I think, was one of his, which wasn't bad. So hopefully it's going to be in the same spirit of the book, just a bit silly, lots of fun visuals, lots of action and things like that. Because that's really what I want from someone. But yet... because he directed WALL-E, I'm sort of like optimistic that he can find another angle to approach it from, another little way of looking at the story. So yeah, like I say, cautiously optimistic about that. Next bit, if you like this, you'll also like go for the Planet of Adventure series by Jack Vance. There's 4 books in that series. I've read them all, and the first 3 are certainly good. The last one is sort of just like, oh, quick, let's wrap up these loose ends here, which gets a bit silly. Also, I mentioned this before, which was The Green Odyssey by Philip Jose Farmer, which was written as, and you can sort of tell in a way, it's written as a pastiche of these old, like, planetary romance, pulpy kind of books in this way. But then there's, like, this actual big science fiction twist at the end, and you're suddenly like, oh, wow, like that, and suddenly it turns into science fiction. Also, I mentioned them before in this podcast as well, go for Lord Valentine's Castle by Robert Silverberg, which is a bit more up-to-date, and also books like Left Hand of Darkness and Dune. Also, you can see the influences that this book, or sort of you can see, like, the extrapolation from A Princess of Mars through to a book like Dune. Say, in Dune, like, you get the... Paul coming down at Arrakis, and then he's like one guy in the wilderness. He's trying to do the whole kind of thing, and there's the I'm not going to explain it all, but you know, you can really see it coming through there. You know, a book which is set with a single person or a small group of people facing the odds on a foreign planet with aliens and fighting and guns and stuff like that. It really does. It makes for good reading in a way. Also, I mentioned this on the last podcast. My own upcoming novella, which still hasn't got a proper name yet, but the working title is Monster Story, which is very self-consciously my own take on the genre, which is completely different from my first released novel, which is Minding Tomorrow. And this is the Monster Story one. It's very much because I wanted to get like the hero kind of thing going on there, and sort of like the different planet and the, you know, out there against the odds by yourself kind of thing going on there. The thing is, people who have read it and given feedback, they're saying, well, you know, the whole hero thing is, it's not actually that interesting. You know, the main character is likable, but he's not actually all that interesting. Whereas I wasn't trying to make him interesting. I was trying to make the sort of an adventure story. So I've either got to go back, and this is what I'm going to be doing over the next week or so, is actually either adding in more character there, or maybe just shortening the story and making a bit more kind of pulpy, or a bit more not fantastic in a way. But it's a bit strange because I was trying to do the same thing with like a framing device as well, which I'm really pleased about that works out well, but there's something slightly missing here from this book, which I'm going to work on over the next few weeks. So anyway, the Monster Story title, I'll be releasing that for free online soon. That's it, I think, everything I wanted to say about the book. So the next book, which I've already read, because I read it, I took a two-day trip, which I'll be talking about probably on my next podcast. I took a two-day trip up to Scotland, and on the way and back on the planes and in the airports, read Shield's Ladder by Greg Egan. I'll review that tomorrow, probably, so not a lot of time between these two podcasts. And I'm just not going to spoil it, but it's hard science fiction, and it's pretty much the opposite of A Princess of Mars in every possible way, which is, except for maybe a little bit at the end. But I'll go into that in my review that I'll be recording and probably releasing tomorrow, or recording and releasing on Sunday. I'm not quite sure because I'm off to Turkey again. So I might do it when I get to Kuşadası or whatever you call it there. So if you've enjoyed this, if you've got any questions or any comments about the feedback, or any feedback, because I do like getting to feedback, and I did enjoy spending 10 minutes talking about the feedback here at the beginning of the podcast. So send me an email, luke@juggler.net. Also still looking for suggestions for the Monster Story, title suggestions for that story, or if you just want to read it, I'll just send it to you, how it is at the moment, and you can give me more feedback. Otherwise, you can follow what books I'm currently reading on goodreads.com/Luke Burridge and send me recommendations. There is a really easy way to doing it, and you can leave comments on my reviews there. Well, not so much comments on the reviews, but you can, when I finish a book, you can say, hey, what about this book, when I give it a star rating. Otherwise, follow me on my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. I put loads of photographs up there, and stories of my travels and other things like that. And finally, you can follow me on Twitter, which is star Luke Burridge on Twitter. Luke Burridge/Twitter. You can find me there as well. And of course, we got up to 4 people watching live here and looking in the chat room, but they're all guests, so I didn't get any single comments. But hopefully the people watching live have enjoyed it. And if you want to see me talking into a microphone, and I just realized this may be the most boring podcast recording that I've done on the video, because I just realized throughout the entire thing, my mouth has been behind the microphone, so you can't actually see my lips moving. And because I didn't actually have the physical book here to read the book and to hold it up and say, point out to thing and refer to things in the book, so I'm not quite sure how animated I've been. I know I've been playing with this little USB adapter throughout the whole thing and not looking at the screen or looking at the camera or anything like that, but hopefully the people enjoyed it, and you can watch that there on Ustream.tv/Luke Burridge or channel Luke Burridge or something. You'll be able to find it. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening, stay in touch, and I'll see you next time.